Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, rebuilding American diplomacy. Ronan Farrow is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, best known for exposing the sexual abuses of Harvey Weinstein. But Farrow began his career working for the State Department under President Obama. He witnessed firsthand the power of diplomacy and its failings. In 2018, he released a book titled War on Peace. It examined America's diminishing investment in diplomacy and loss of influence around the world. Now he's back with an updated edition examining the final years of the Trump administration and the beginning of Biden's presidency. Ronan Farrow joined me to talk about that and his upcoming HBO documentary series, Catch and Kill, The Podcast Tapes. Ronan, you begin this updated book, War on Peace, with a 35-year diplomat, Thomas Countryman, who at the time was ambassador to Jordan. Tell me why you begin with his story.
Well, he is particularly interesting, Diane, because he was actually working in a senior role focused on arms control at the time. And he did have an important diplomatic mission that he was on that began in Jordan and had several other steps that would follow, and then didn't because he was stone cold fired right in the middle of that trip. And it kicked off a period at the very outset of the Trump administration where we really saw a pretty unprecedented disregard for career diplomats. And this was interesting to me because I had been at the State Department for a number of years in a very junior role, but seeing some of these individuals and the risks they take to keep the United States safe and prosperous and the importance of their work. And it was interesting to me because I had been doing PhD research for a number of years on some of these dynamics of what happens when you kick diplomats out of the room and allow the military to fill the void. So Thomas Countryman was a little bit of a canary in the coal mine because what happened right after was something that actually became known as the Mahogany Row Massacre. Mahogany Row being the top floor of the State Department where the Secretary of State works, and the massacre being this wave of firings and attempted firings that really augured a very dark time in the history of the State Department in the last few years.
I have to tell you that in the late 50s, I also worked at the State Department as a secretary and met my future husband there, who was an attorney. So the State Department means a great deal to me. I saw how hard those diplomats worked. So I am very sympathetic to the story of Thomas Countryman, but talk generally about what Trump left behind at that State Department.
Well, it's extraordinary that you have that part of your history. I had read that, and you clearly feel that connection to that place too. It's a building that is often dysfunctional and broken, as government bureaucracies can be. I don't think any sane person would call it a model of efficiency, but I think we dismantle it at our peril. And we see the lessons of that over and over again around the world. And that's what the book is about. It's about what happens in these various places when we disempower these men and women who do really pivotal work to maintaining America's place in the world. And the consequence, to answer your question, during the Trump era was, we became more isolated. We became more militarized in our posture in many strategically important places around the world. And ultimately, we lost trust both internally with the people who make the policies happen, these diplomats, and also with our allies and even enemies around the world. You know, we became a presence that is taken significantly less seriously. And there are a lot of metrics that I use to judge that. It's not just sort of an anecdotal statement I make. I think you can really persuasively make that argument after the Trump era.
And to be very clear about it, Donald Trump did not trust the State Department. He felt that he could far better run foreign relations than the State Department could. But things started to go wrong right from the beginning.
Yes, that's right. You know, we saw Donald Trump careen through 4 years of shaking hands with dictators who historically had not been allowed access and favor with the White House, of, you know, unfettered arms deals that in some cases under Pompeo, you know, triggered inspector general investigations for being improper. And, you know, a real worsening of conditions on the ground in a number of hotspots that I profile and report on that I think you can trace either directly or indirectly or both to this diminishing of diplomacy. And I want to make clear, this is not a new phenomenon and it's not a problem that's exclusive to Donald Trump. One of the things that I discovered is it's a nonpartisan challenge. We've seen administrations dating back to Clinton really sideline the State Department. Warren Christopher got up on the Hill and asked for budget cuts that were very much in the neighborhood of what Rex Tillerson, Trump's first Secretary of State, asked for. And, you know, some Clinton people get mad if you suggest this parallel, but the fact is, after the Cold War, it became very appealing for politicians to talk about a return to domestic priorities and, you know, getting out of all this international stuff. And, you know, while there are ways in which that argument is compelling, I think one thing that we've learned from that era, and I, you know, I lay out the specific economics and strategic ramifications of this in the book, is that we get left flat-footed when the next international crisis emerges if we do that. So the State Department was really short-staffed and under-empowered by the time we got to 9/11, which was, for all sorts of reasons, wider than our treatment of diplomats in the State Department, a hyper-militarized time in America's posture in the world. And you know, these dynamics have collided to create a situation where we really very often don't have enough civilian diplomats making decisions and shaping policy and on the ground to do the work that we need them to do and carry the expertise that we rely on them for. I mean, that's the thing, Diane. We lose our ability to even clock what the challenge is in some of these cases. That brings us back to Tom Countryman. He's one of many people that I profile in this book who I think embody that. But he is certainly someone who had decades of expertise in a very specific area, arms control, where we desperately need deep experts. And, you know, we threw that out.
So what you seem to be saying is that as the military budget grew, the diplomatic budget of the State Department seemed to be reduced almost in similar amounts.
Well, the growth of defense spending has skyrocketed to a much greater extent than the State Department has shrunk. And it's more complicated than just budget and staff size. It's a nexus of the extent to which diplomats have primacy in the policy process as opposed to generals. You know, we saw under Trump an administration in which the White House was full of generals. That's yet another phenomenon that's not unique to Trump, because Obama, particularly in his first term, was very much seduced by celebrity generals. You know, people like Petraeus and McChrystal, you know, took up a lot of space and elbowed out a number of diplomats. My portfolio was Afghanistan when I was at the State Department. And so I used that as a case study. And it's been fascinating to do the reporting for this book and hear a lot of senior Obama administration officials say, you know, yeah, maybe that was a mistake, and we tried to course correct in the second term. And, you know, we saw it again under Trump to a far greater extent, that he just really wanted military voices in the room as often as possible and ceded more and more power for decision and policymaking to the Pentagon in cases at times where you would have had both civilian and military voices in the past. So there's all sorts of measures by which the State Department has been diminished, but I think it's inarguable that it has and that it's going to be tough to come back from.
What about Richard Holbrooke?
So Richard Holbrooke is another fascinating lens into this broad sweep of history and what we think of diplomats and how much we trust them or not and how much we empower them. You know, he was someone who, starting as a young public servant during the Vietnam era, passionately believed that you need civilian voices to counterbalance military excess. And, you know, obviously history proved him right about Vietnam. And he went on to be this hard-charging diplomat who really had a significant historical impact in Bosnia. You know, he brokered a highly imperfect peace that nevertheless saved a lot of lives and rightly had a significant legacy because of it. And I wound up working for him when I was very young, coming right out of law school as this junior diplomat at the State Department, and being able to see a pretty tragic period in his life and history when he wanted to do the same thing that he had done in Bosnia, but for Afghanistan, and where he knew that everyone would say that that was foolhardy, Afghanistan being the graveyard of empires and as complicated a situation as one can charge into, but believing that negotiations with the Taliban and approaches that integrated soft power were necessary. And he was an interesting lens through which to view this because, Diane, he was not, as you know, a dove. You know, he believed in using military power as part of the United States' arsenal, but he also believed that that shouldn't be the only approach and that it should be part of a strategy built by civilians. And there were eerie echoes between his experience watching unfettered military escalation for too long in Vietnam and his experiences watching what he believed to be the same in Afghanistan. And in this book, I published for the first time a number of his secret memoranda that he was sending in a state of desperation to Hillary Clinton. You know, I only made those public after his death, which I think is what he would have wanted. And, you know, he was sounding the alarm in several different directions. He was talking to Bob Woodward, who also then after his death released those conversations on the same logic, but making the case that diplomats had exited the room and we were getting stuck in an unending war at the ends of the earth yet again as a result. And he, in the end, both was sidelined and not heard due to a combination of the atmosphere I'm talking about and the acceptance of diplomats or lack thereof, and also personal politics. He was his own worst enemy. He pissed everyone off. He was a nightmare to deal with in many respects. You know, but he was also beloved, and he was also right, I believe, in many of those arguments. And so he wasn't heard, and he, in the end, died in that job, which was, you know, a very traumatic experience for me on a personal level, and I really lost a mentor.
Tell us about your own early experience at the State Department at age 20. What was your role, and how did it affect your outlook on the value of diplomacy?
I didn't know, I think, what I wanted to do when I entered that line of work. I had been writing kind of heavily reported op-eds as a freelancer. So, you know, journalism and storytelling had always been a component from pretty early on. I had done way too much school, and I ultimately went on to do a PhD after that law degree. You know, so I was scholarly, and I liked learning about the world. And I believed in public service. I mean, you mentioned before we went live an old interview you'd done with my mother when she was doing volunteer work for UNICEF. And that was informative for me growing up, that, you know, she was someone who cared profoundly about public service. And I think probably from her Catholic schoolgirl background, you know, took away from that, you know, whatever one's misgivings about the church might be, certainly that hair shirt spirit of public service to the exclusion of everything else. And so I don't know how much I live up to that ethos, but I did in my early career choices after getting out of school very much want to serve. And, you know, considered a number of things, including the military side of things, but had interned for Richard Holbrook between college and law school and had this connection with him and actually then ran into Hillary Clinton. I tell this story in the book at an inaugural event that I had no business being at, but a friend had brought me to. And Hillary Clinton and I had gone to the same law school, and she was very kind. And she, suggested that I connect with Holbrook, who she knew that I had a relationship with. And at that point, I believe it was not yet public that he was going to go into that administration. But he was behind the scenes building this role of, can I take on this last great challenge? You know, I don't think he knew it was going to be his last, but there were some ways in which it did feel a little like a suicide mission to try to fix Afghanistan after so many generations had failed, not just failed from the American perspective, but failed the Afghan people. We really, I think the Western powers, Russia and the United States during the Cold War, left Afghanistan, shall we say, worse for the wear. And I fear, you know, the result of this more recent era has been the same. But because of all that, you know, I wound up there as a very young person in this very junior role, seeing these historic events and seeing these sort of titans of this, in some ways, lost art. You know, Richard Holbrook, in his desperate last stand, making the case for the institution of diplomacy. And he built, this is another plot thread in this book, a really eccentric, colorful team of experts from outside of diplomacy, of career diplomats, of technical experts within the government, you know, agriculture experts, intelligence experts, and kind of put together an all-star team of people who in some ways were misfits or, you know, not part of the system. And the system was a little bit suspicious of us and of that office. It was called Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And of course, everything in government has acronyms. So it was SRAP. And we were in these very unglamorous offices on the first floor by the cafeteria, which was terrible for Richard Holbrook's health because he ate terribly and was always stopping at the cafeteria or the bodega next to the cafeteria. But, you know, we had this incredible coming and going of world leaders and celebrities and experts in and out of those doors.
And where were you in all of this?
I was sitting right there, and I moved desks a few times, but it was always next to someone fascinating. And, you know, at one point I sat next to Barney Rubin, who's, you know, this storied Afghanistan expert and academic, Rina Miri, who Richard Holbrook mostly, in an exaggeration, used to say wrote the Afghan constitution, and she would roll her eyes. You know, these are names that might not mean much to people outside of this little narrow ambit of Afghanistan, but they're significant figures in that field and in shaping the course of American strategy in that region. And I got kind of a ground level view into that and saw all of these different manifestations, Diane, of the diminishing of the profession as we were undertaking this challenge. You know, another story I tell in the book is of this career diplomat, Robin Rafel, who got accused of espionage for the work that she was doing in Pakistan. And it's a fascinating little yarn. You know, she arrives home to find her house crawling with FBI agents, and they're sifting through all of her documents and trying to find anything they can on her. Did she ever accidentally take home a classified document? You know, and they find enough to really thrust her into a crisis for years and turn her life upside down. But it does seem, you know, I won't spoil how it came out for those who didn't follow the story at the time and want to read the book, but it really does seem that one component of that was the wider government and an increasingly military heavy and intelligence heavy leadership not understanding the old school work of diplomacy.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Ronan Farrow.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Ronan Farrow. He's a contributing writer to The New Yorker and author of War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy, and the Decline of American Influence. The question becomes now, President Biden is in office. Has he taken steps, small ones even, to correct what's happened to the State Department?
So the answer is undoubtedly yes, if the threshold is, you know, has he taken steps, even small ones? And the diplomats I spoke to, and there were hundreds of sources in this book, many of them career State Department officials, they were in a state of deep disillusionment coming out of the Trump administration, and they were immensely heartened by the fact that on the campaign trail, Joe Biden talked about reprioritizing civilian diplomacy. That said, I include some of this in the new edition of the book, and it's in a New Yorker piece from last week that I published. There are misgivings already 6 months into this administration about whether enough is being done to attend to this problem.
But isn't that, in fact, the case that perhaps you're making this judgment a little early, 6 months into Biden's administration?
You know, that is the argument that you obviously get from Tony Blinken's camp, Tony being the new Secretary of State. And it's the argument you get more widely within the Biden administration. I don't think it's an unfair defense to say wait and see. That said, I think it is instructive to hear the people on the inside saying exactly what they think is still stalling.
Such as?
The most interesting argument that emerges in those conversations is that in a zeal to distance themselves from the kind of careening unilateral leadership of Trump and his secretaries of state, figures who disregarded the input of the building and the wider government, situations where Donald Trump would be forging ahead into brokering alliances with some pretty shady figures without ever talking to a single expert. In an effort to create distance from that kind of posture, a number of career officials who served across multiple parties told me that they feel the Biden administration is being deliberately slow and consultative. And that while there are advantages to that, it has reached a point of excess in several policy areas, including, for instance, in Iraq, which was raised as an example by several of these individuals because it's a little less in the spotlight right now, but nevertheless has, you know, serious life or death consequences, depending on what we decide there in terms of our ongoing presence and our strategy. The piece lays out clearly and fairly the responses of the Biden administration, which includes the argument that you made of, you know, it's just too soon. But the fact is, 6 months of policymaking is a meaningful start. And if there are pivotal people on the inside who say these new folks are very nice and their intentions are right, but not enough is being done to jumpstart this kind of diplomatically led policymaking, and not enough is being done to staunch the bleeding in terms of staffing and resourcing at the State Department, that's another complaint that, you know, we actually have not yet seen the headcount of Foreign Service officers at the State Department increase. Fair enough to say it's going to take time to see change, but also I think appropriate for those people on the inside to turn whistleblower and say, hey, let's keep the heat on, because these are deep wounds. They're going to take a long time to fix fully. And the work, in their view, has to start now.
It does strike me that Tony Blinken, has been given such a large portfolio, especially in light of the COVID virus, you know, I still come back to the idea he is a dedicated professional. He will do what's necessary. He does need more money. He does need more time. And in a State Department that has been so disheartened and so dysfunctional and so deteriorated, it's going to take quite a while, it would seem to me.
Without a doubt, you know, I talked to 10 secretaries of state on the record for this book, and it was fascinating to get their perspectives. But one way in which those perspectives tended to align was it's going to take a long time to heal. You know, John Kerry says in this book, it might be a generation before we restore expertise at the State Department to where it should be, because it's not as simple as, you know, rehiring. The kind of expertise that you need is a decades-long pipeline. You need people like Tom Countryman who start in that system young and learn and learn and learn about their field within that system. And, you know, the argument Kerry makes is you're just not going to have the trained career ambassadors that you need in 30 years, in 40 years after the Trump era where there were all these firings. So yes, it is a long-term problem. And yes, Tony Blinken has inherited an incredible challenge that would be daunting, I think, for any public servant, however dedicated. And I think that the, you know, the scuttlebutt within the building on Blinken is positive. You know, people feel relieved to have someone who is consultative and cares about the building and has been in it before and had a reputation when he was a deputy in prior administrations for being kind and a good boss. You know, I think all of that is welcome and acknowledged. And nevertheless, I think the unenviable position of being in that position and carrying that challenge is there's going to be effort to keep the heat on him and officials around him to throw themselves into this challenge and do the almost impossible in setting the State Department right.
One wonders how much U.S. diplomacy is actually trusted abroad. We have made so many enemies during the Trump administration, and now there's a period of repair and reclaim that must go on, and it's got to be so tough.
Yes, I mean, there are international alliances and deals that we either stepped away from or eroded in some way over the past few years. And, you know, some of the rectifying of that can be straightforward, like, you know, rejoining the Paris Climate Change Accord. And in some cases, there are situations where we've really lost a foothold, you know, in various international trade agreements where we left and the void was filled by other institutions or competing powers. In terms of investment in difficult hotspots where we stepped back at times when China or Russia or others are on the rise and filling that space in diplomacy and development. So there will be lasting consequences. And as you say, there has been a lot of trust lost. And, you know, this is not a monolithic view. It's not starry-eyed or simple. It's not saying diplomacy is perfect or it's the only answer. It is, going back to the lessons of Richard Holbrook, a tool in the arsenal. And a number of officials actually used this phrase. I think Bill Burns is one of them, now the CIA director. But back when I was in the administration, a deputy secretary of state, you know, calls it the tool of first resort. And over again, you hear that phrase, that diplomacy should be the tool of first resort, and it can save lives if it's used in that way.
In your new epilogue, you write about Trump's first impeachment. You call it the diplomats versus the president. Who won?
It's a really good question and a good way to frame it. It's difficult to say. You know, in some ways, that felt like the perfect epilogue, not just because there are brilliant characters to profile in there, real profiles in courage. You know, people like William Taylor, the career ambassador that I follow through that period in history. But also because it is a moment of catharsis, right? They do get up on the hill, and they do push back, and they do say, hey, this is a case, you know, talking about Ukraine and the accusations that Trump curried political favors there. They say, hey, this is wrong. And professional diplomacy was eclipsed by sort of cronyism and corruption, with bad consequences. And they do shine a light on that and create some accountability there. On the other hand, to your point about who won, diplomacy has been left a kind of hollowed, shambling version of the institution that it can and should be. You know, the people in the Trump administration who were responsible for that sidelining of diplomats and introduction of political corruption suffered little or no consequences, depending on the case. And, you know, the broken system left behind is still healing. So I think it's a cathartic ending, but also a bittersweet one.
I want to turn to your upcoming documentary series on HBO about your reporting on the Harvey Weinstein Catch and Kill, the podcast tapes. Tell us what we can expect.
You know, it's a project, Diane, that I didn't expect, to be frank. I wrote this book, which was incredibly grueling, and, you know, the fact-checking process on it was so intensive. And it also was the first time in this reporting, which I feel so fortunate to have been able to do, and was thanks to all these brave sources, that I also had to tell my own part of the story. And I thought that was important because reporters were getting followed around by spies hired by Harvey Weinstein and intimidated legally and physically in some cases. And, you know, that is a miniature and lower stakes version of something that reporters deal with around the world. I'm very lucky to be in a country where what I do is protected, and that's not the case everywhere. And I thought it was worth going there, and I tried my damnedest to do it in a way that wasn't self-aggrandizing, but was, you know, instructive and told a meaningful story that would help others, you know, more than just shed light on myself.
How did you first start reporting on Harvey Weinstein?
Well, that's all, you know, that's in that book, Catch and Kill. It was something I stumbled into a bit because I was doing investigative reporting for television, for the Today Show and NBC, and, you know, working with some great journalists and producers there and loved that job and was working on a story about Hollywood and the casting couch and came upon the Harvey Weinstein allegations and very rapidly started getting people on camera talking about the Harvey Weinstein allegations. And, you know, that then turned into a bit of a game of cat and mouse where, you know, I was going through much less than the sources were going through in terms of trauma or setbacks, but my life did sort of fall apart around that story. So the book was challenging to write. And then I loved having the opportunity for a return to that story for this podcast, where I had both, you know, recorded some of the interviews during the process of the initial reporting and then went and did further on-camera interviews. And it turned into the Catch and Kill podcast, which was more focused on the sources than on me, which is always a relief, and for which, you know, these incredibly brave people got to talk through their process of coming forward with me. And that found an audience, and I figured that would be it. But we did have all of this beautifully shot footage of these incredible characters, you know, men and women, everyone from, you know, some of the spies who followed me and others around and then turned into whistleblowers to these women who had broken through a culture of silence at great personal risk. You know, they graciously shared their stories. And I'll tell you, as much as I didn't expect to see that on television after all this, it's a funny coming full circle, Diane, because it was supposed to be a TV story I was working on, and then it wasn't. And that was a big point of contention. And now it is. And as much as I said when HBO proposed that they wanted to give this huge reservoir of footage to a couple of very talented filmmakers, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, who actually created RuPaul's Drag Race, of all things, incredibly talented and eclectic filmmakers. I said, you know, well, I love them, so I'm maybe curious to see what they come up with. But, you know, does this need to be heard? You know, that's always my threshold with this kind of reporting. And when they started showing me rough cuts, I really came to believe, oh, wow, it does. Because seeing these faces and not just hearing, but seeing what people go through as they take these risks is really instructive. And we've also, you know, put it into a brand new structure. It's new and different scripts. It's different pieces of footage. There's some new revelations in there. So I'm excited for people to see it, and I'm grateful to all those sources.
Ronan, for those who don't know, your parents are Mia Farrow and Woody Allen, and your sister, Dylan, accused your father of sexually abusing her when she was just a child. So how much did your family's history motivate your reporting on this and continue to motivate you?
Well, it became a significant part of the story as I lay out in that book, because Harvey Weinstein, you know, began throwing that family history in my face in a very kind of vicious and personal way. And, you know, I was getting legal threat letters that were arguing that I couldn't or shouldn't report on issues of sexual violence because it was a conflict of interest, because someone in my family had been sexually assaulted. And, you know, this is quite a silly argument journalistically and legally. That's not how conflicts of interest work. Of course, you can be passionate about the subject. Of course, you can object to rape and still report on rape. But, you know, at the time, it's easy to kind of have short-term memory loss. Harvey Weinstein was someone who carried a lot of weight and was able to call up a lot of executives and make this argument and send spooky threat letters from very big name lawyers. And, you know, really threatened to wipe out me and my career. And I did lose my job over it. And again, that's much less than a great many people around this story went through. So, you know, I'm grateful in the end for that part of my family history. And I wear it as a badge of honor that it was thrown in my face in that way, because it did in the end, although it was complicated and I wanted to run from that aspect of it, it did motivate me on some level. And it did help me understand the stakes.
You were worried about your sister's going public with her story. Why?
I think in every family where there's a terrible crime, you know, even more so if possible in families where there's a terrible crime and an accusation of such a thing directed at a powerful person, Woody Allen, who can mobilize a lot of resources to come after the family, there are going to be misgivings. And I see every time I report on a story of crime or corruption and it involves coming forward against powerful interests, the many and complicated reasons why sources hesitate and the journey that their loved ones go through in frequently telling them not to talk and to shut up. And I thought it was important in Catch and Kill to lay out in an emotionally vulnerable and honest way my own version of that journey, where, you know, I supported my sister and I believed her, but I didn't really want to confront the evidence in full. And the last thing that I wanted to do was lose more of our lives to that trauma. And of course, it's, you know, it's her trauma more than it is mine. But, you know, when you're a child growing up around that kind of a situation, it does affect everyone. So I come at these conversations with sources as an investigative reporter with a degree of sensitivity because I've been there myself and I understand all the reasons why you would want to do everything but talk about the worst parts of your life or, you know, the most important malfeasance you've ever been a witness to. But that's why we need whistleblowers and sources who are brave and confront those things, because that's how we affect change. And I was no hero in this. I really had to kind of be dragged there by circumstance. So it redoubles my gratitude for the people who take that leap in every investigative story that I do.
I'm glad. Tell me how your family is today.
Thank you for asking. They're doing well. You know, there was a documentary recently by a couple of very good filmmakers, Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick, that I agreed to participate in. And, you know, the journey that I chart in Catch and Kill is of me going from sort of running from these personal demons to understanding that I have to look at the evidence and confront it. That said, it's not something I ever relish talking about. And, mostly I feel like I have said my piece on that judiciously, and I don't see a reason to return to it. They made a film where they persuaded me that they were doing work of real investigative brio and that it would be historically significant, and they're significant filmmakers. So I did agree to do an interview for them after some period of reluctance, and they did good and important work. But, you know, it's a reminder that none of this comes easy. That film really spun up a tremendous machine of opposition and, you know, smear efforts. And, you know, really it was the better part of a year of just, you know, my social media being overtaken by very, very obviously paid, you know, troll farms of bots issuing all kinds of threats and slurs and really below the belt horrific stuff. Augmented by, I think, a small and devoted cadre of sort of super fans of Woody Allen, super fans of Michael Jackson. There's a shared community of, people who have banded together, who feel that high profile men subject to allegations of that particular kind of abuse are being railroaded in some way and are very angry at the women who have done it and the people who have stood up for those women. So it can be punishing, and you know, you start to recognize the patterns of when you talk about these difficult issues, the negative press coverage that appears, the opposition that appears. But I view it mostly as part of my job. And I hope that the personal manifestation of that around my own family stuff is something that I have been forthright and open about, and to the best of my abilities, struggled to do the right thing on, and that'll be that. You know, I don't know how many more years of documentaries and investigative pieces about that case there can be. And I am glad that the evidence is out there, and I'm glad that my sister was as brave as she was. I'm very proud of her. But yes, not a fun process either.
Ronan, all I can say is thank you for your work.
Diane, thank you for all that you do. I mean, you are such a rare phenomenon in this day and age, and you've been doing it for so long and so beautifully to bring us this kind of serious coverage and these serious conversations. And I've been grateful for it on issue after issue. So thank you, and I'll keep listening.
Thank you. That was Ronan Farrow. He is a contributing writer to The New Yorker and the author of two books, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence, and Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and the Conspiracy to Protect Predators. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be safe. Stay well. I'm Diane Rehm.